Good morning, everyone. Sorry we're running a bit late here. I didn't realize it was after 9. This meeting is called to order March 30th, 2011 at 9:10 a.m. Before proceeding with any business, I believe Mr. Smith has a statement to make.
I do, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. A public notice of this meeting containing all items on the proposed agenda has been filed in the office of the Secretary of State as required by Chapter 551 Government Code, referred to as the Open Meetings Act. I'd like for this fact to be noted in the official record of the meeting. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, thank you. A couple of things. Let me start out with, I want to introduce, we have a new commissioner, Dick Scott. Dick is right over here. Dick has been involved in various things. Obviously, he went to Harvard on the Neches River. I hadn't heard that, but I remembered it. Graduated from Lamar University, lives up in that part of the world, but where are you living now? No, you're born in Wimberley. Or?
Actually, about halfway between Griffin Springs and Wimberley.
Yeah, okay. Okay. Good. I appreciate moving in. I'm a Blanco County guy, so I'm glad.
That's a good talk.
Dick has also been on the Lower Colorado River Authority, and they just rewarded him by letting him off that board and on to TPW, where we even have less money. So, welcome aboard, and I'm glad you're here, Dick. Thank you very much. And also, believe it or not, has been already approved by the Senate, so he must know somebody up there. That, the rest of us, it took us about 3 years to get approved. But welcome aboard. Secondly, is Professor Doug Slack has his group here that he brings once a year. From Texas A&M, his wildlife and fisheries conservation class. And Professor Slack, do you want to stand up and have your students stand up that are here, please? Because we appreciate them coming.
Great day to be an Aggie.
Congratulations on your women's team, yes. I think that was a little bit of a shocker for Bader, wasn't it? Onward, onward. Congratulations. I assume that's what you were referring to. Now, your favorite governor would say it's always a good day to be an Aggie. With that, we'll get started with Regulations Committee this morning. Chairman Friedkin, please call your committee to order.
Thank you. Okay. First order of business is approval of previous committee meeting minutes. Motion for approval.
Moved.
Second. By Commissioner Fickson, second by Commissioner Falcone. All in favor?
Aye.
Go.
I have a correction.
Already?
So that I read. page 21, I'm quoted as saying, is that intended?
That's why it bothered him.
is that intended to refer to a trot line jug, a rim line? Rim should have been limb. Is that correction?
So with that correction,
you're getting tougher by the day.
Any opposed? Okay, no discussion on that. We all okay with that?
Yes.
Okay.
Are you indicating that the law business is not doing too well up here in Walmart?
We've always got room for more.
The motion carries. Committee item number one, update on Parks and Wildlife progress in implementing the TPWD Land and Water Resources Conservation and Recreation Plan. Carter.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate that. This morning, we do not have any action items to report on from the Land and Water Plan, but certainly at the next meeting, we absolutely will. We'll be giving you an update on some of our milestones with respect to our progress there. Just a couple items of interest that I do want to report on. One thing that I think was enormously productive over the last year was an interim committee that was championed by Representative Tan Parker from up in the North Texas, North Dallas area on a recreational boating advisory panel that assembled a bunch of different stakeholders to look at different boating safety and water safety mechanisms that could be implemented to keep our lake safer, our boaters safer, and also to help us from a law enforcement perspective. And I want to brag on our boating law administrator, Game Warden Jeff Parrish, and Cody Jones, who were intimately involved in that process and really did a great job. A number of bills that Representative Parker has brought forward this session that I think will provide some substantive improvements in there to just keep boaters safer on the water. So an important development there. Y'all will remember, I think, receiving a couple of letters from petitioners that were asking the commission to consider opening up a bow hunting season in Collin County near Dallas. That's a near urban county near Dallas. It currently does not have a deer season. The petitioners, including Representative Laudenberg, had asked that we consider, or y'all consider, establishing an archery season there to create additional hunting opportunities for those, not unlike Grayson County. We have informed Representative Laudenberg and other petitioners that we plan to look at that issue over the summer, have our biologists evaluate that, and maybe look at it in the context of an urban resource management unit where we have kind of urban and near-urban counties that currently don't have a deer season, but which might be able to have sufficient deer populations that could sustain an archery-only type season, again, not unlike Grayson County. And so what we'd like to do, with y'all's permission, is just have our biologists kind of study that issue, think about the idea of establishing an urban resource management unit, and then come back and visit with y'all in November to see if that idea would bear fruit. And so kind of with your concurrence, we'd like to proceed in that direction. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'm finished with my remarks, and I'll turn it back over to you unless there's any questions.
Appreciate it. Thank you. All right. Committee item number two, potential changes to the Migratory Game Bird Proclamation. Request permission to publish proposed changes in the Texas Register. Evan's coming up.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. For the record, my name is Kevin Cry, Waterfowl Program Leader for the Wildlife Division. And today, I'm here to visit with you about the upcoming 2011-2012 migratory game bird hunting seasons. More specifically, to kick off the annual regulations process, whereby we'll be requesting from this committee permission to publish in the State Register comments from the public. The Wildlife Division has developed a suite of season dates that has recently been approved by our Migratory Game Bird Advisory Committee, as well as our Technical Committee. The important thing to note with migratory game birds is that U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service ultimately has final say over the rulemaking process. And so the dates I'm going to show you here today could potentially change significantly as data comes in later this spring. To begin with, I'll talk about dove seasons. We do expect a 70-day season again this year, along with a 15-bird daily bag limit for all zones. With specifically the north and central zones, we are proposing that they run concurrent again this year, with the traditional season opener being the first day of September, running to October 23rd, closing for a split, and then reopening the second segment on December 24th, which is Christmas Eve, and then running out their allowable 70 days, being January 9th. As for the south zone, currently the earliest day at which we can open the south zone with the current rules is September 23rd through October 30th, reopen December 24th with the rest of the state, and then run out at 70 days, being January 24th. I will quickly reference a potential change to that that we have before the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service right now, and I'll speak about that in more detail in a minute. Specifically in the south zone, within the special white-winged dove hunting area, we are allowed 4 early days to take advantage of white wings in that zone. And traditionally, those are the first 2 full weekends in September. Those are half-day hunting in those first 4 days. And we expect a 15-bird aggregate, of which no more than 4 may be mourning doves in that zone. It will then reopen along with the rest of the south zone, being September 23rd, running through October 30th, and then reopening with the rest of the state, December 24th, and running out its allowable 70 days, that being January 20th, which is 4 days less than the rest of the south zone. To get a look at that, all the dove seasons on some calendars, we'll begin with the north and central zones. In blue, you can see denotes the season dates for the north and central dove zones. With respect to the south zone and the special white-winged dove hunting area, in green, you can see the 4 early half days the first two full weekends in September. And then in blue denotes the regular season for both the south and the special white-winged dove hunting area. And in orange, you can see the 4 days for just the south zone outside the special white-winged dove hunting area that will allow the full complement of the 70 days. As I mentioned earlier, we do have a current proposal before the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to address the opening date. In 2009, Texas Parks and Wildlife developed a recommendation to create a consistent opening date in the south zone for landowners and land managers to plan appropriately, and that being about the third week of September. Basically, what happened is we did not account for leap year with the future calendars, and as you can see with the current proposals, the earliest date we can open is September 23rd in the south zone. So basically, right now, the current rulemaking process for that is we're allowed to choose the Friday nearest September 20th, but no earlier than the 17th. Well, we cleaned up that verbiage and now have a recommendation requesting the Friday nearest the third Saturday, or the Friday closest to the third Saturday in September. So until that gets approved, these are the current dates that we're allowed to. But just for your information, and assuming this would get approved, and likely we'll see this in future meetings, the next calendar shows what that would look like. And basically, it's just a calendar shift 1 week earlier, such that the regular season would open on the 16th, and then the closure for both the south zone and the special white wing area would be the 13th, and then just the south zone outside the special white wing area would be the 17th. So you may see this again earlier, and we just thought it was important that we give you the heads up on this. Moving on to teal seasons. Currently, the service allows either 16 or 9 day. Excuse me.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
Commissioner Duggan.
The north and central zone second season dates, did the Migratory Game Committee consider moving that up a day so that it began on the 23rd, which would be Friday, since the 9th is a Monday? And I was thinking about how to expand the options there for people to get out. And
yes, sir.
It seems to me that might be worthy of consideration.
Okay.
So was that discussed at the...
No, I don't believe that was. I think with the onset of the creation of this split season across the state, at least last year when it was vetted through our committees, it was thought that it'd be best to open on that Saturday. But that's certainly a possibility that can be looked into.
Well, my thought was that very few people are likely to hunt on Christmas Eve.
Yes, sir.
Yet they might on the day before.
Day before.
Because most people aren't working, and they're not likely to use January 9th, which is a Monday. It just seems like we might provide more opportunity to our hunters in those two zones if we tweak that by moving it up a day. How the rest of you think about it?
I will make sure that we investigate that with our committee and see if that's something they'd be interested in, and potentially bring that forward to you at a later meeting. So we have that room within the federal frameworks to do that.
Okay. I agree. I think it'd be good to look at that and potentially create more opportunities. So we could be grateful.
Yes, sir. Okay. With respect to early teal seasons, as I was saying earlier, service allows either a 16 or a 9 day season. If it's a 16-day season, typically it'll be the last three full weekends of September, being the 10th through the 25th. And if we're given a 9 day teal season selection, it'd be the 17th through the 25th. My crystal ball says, considering the conditions that we're currently seeing in the prairie, it will most likely be the first, being the 10th through the 25th, which is a 16-day season. With respect to rails, gallinule, snipe, and woodcock, for rail and gallinule, we like to have historically opened concurrent with the early teal seasons. So you can see a September 10 through 25 season there to run concurrent with teal season. And then reopen on November 5th, which is kind of important because that is a change from last year, and that reflects a concurrent opener with the duck seasons I'm about to propose to you. And then concluding on December 28th. As for snipe as well, the November 5th opener to open concurrent with duck season and run its full allotment of its allowable frameworks, and that being February 19th. With respect to woodcock, Fish and Wildlife Service allows us 45 days of woodcock hunting, which the latest day being January 31st. So we simply historically have started on the 31st and backed up 45 days, that being December 18th. Now moving on to ducks, mergansers, and coots. We'll start with the High Plains Mallard Management Unit, but at first I'd like to talk about some changes that we may see that we're proposing for ducks across all zones. Over the last few years, we've received considerable public comment regarding the selection of a season that did not go to the end of allowable frameworks. That topic was recently vetted through our in-house Migratory Game Bird Tech Committee, as well as our Migratory Game Bird Advisory Committee. After looking at all the pros and cons of this topic, including everything from an earlier shifting calendar over the next few years, public opinion, migration chronology, other opening days of migratory game birds, and potential conflict with big game opening season dates, ultimately, there was a unanimous decision from both groups that the season that provides the best opportunity for duck hunters across the entire state of Texas, and maybe even more importantly, waterfowl hunters in general when considering a trending delay in goose migrations, that the season that season would be one that would conclude at the end of allowable federal frameworks, being the last Sunday in January. The other thing I would like to preface before I show you our proposals for duck season is these dates are all prefaced on the fact that Fish and Wildlife Service setting a liberal framework. And obviously, if that does not happen, these dates would change significantly. Again, like I said, with teal season, conditions are better than maybe they've ever been in human history right now with the snow and the water prior. So we do expect a liberal season. So these dates are probably pretty accurate. Specifically with the High Plains Mallard Management Unit highlighted there, our proposals are traditional youth season the weekend before the regular opener, that being October 22nd and 23rd. The following weekend, the 29th and 30th, being the opener of the regular season, and the closing for 4 days, and then reopening on Friday, November 4th, running to the end of allowable frameworks, being January 29th. We do expect U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to implement a delay, a five-day delay on Mallard ducks again this year, and that would be for the High Plains Zone on November 7th. To look at that, plot it out on a calendar. In green, you can see what the early teal season dates would look like for a 16-day season. The gray boxes, the 22nd, 23rd, would be the youth seasons. And then the blue would denote the regular seasons for the High Plains unit. As for the north and south zones, we expect a 76-day season when you include youth season. That being the weekend before regular season, October 29th and 30th for those zones. Then the regular season opening November 5th and running through November 27th, which is the Sunday after Thanksgiving, and then reopening 2 weeks later on December 10th to run to January 29th. Again, same as the High Plains unit, we do expect a five-day delay in the model duck season, and that would be November 10th for these two zones. To have a look at that on a calendar, again, with the north and south zones, the green denotes the teal season, the gray boxes denote the proposed youth season prior to the regular season, and then the blue boxes denote the regular season closing January 29th. As for proposed bag limits statewide, we do expect, again, a six-day aggregate bag limit for ducks, that being of which no more than three may be wood ducks, scop, two hen mallards, two scop, two redheads, two pintails, one canvasback, one dusky duck, which is a mottled black or Mexican-like duck in their hybrids, and there is a potential, we do expect a five-day delay on that. And all other duck species, we expect a six-bird bag limit. As for mergansers, we expect five per day, of which no more than two may be hooded. And then the ever-elusive coot is a 15-bird bag limit. Moving on to geese, we'll begin with our eastern zone. And there are a couple changes here that I'd like to point out that we'll be proposing to this committee. The first being vetted in the fact that the duck season we're proposing is moving later. So in order to keep regulations similar, the goose season opener will also be moved back a week, that being November 5th, and for light geese running to January 29th, which is also the closure of the duck season in the north and south zones. Specifically relating to Canada geese, we are proposing a new Canada goose season. And that being 2 extra weeks of Canada goose only hunting opportunity. This season is proposed as an early season in September to run concurrent with teal season and is designed to take advantage of a growing population of resident or non-migratory Canada geese in the northeastern portion of the state. And in some locations, those birds are being considered to be nuisance birds. and you can see there in red, that would be the season dates that we're proposing. And that is also the season dates for the teal season, September 10 through September 25. Then with the regular dark goose season opening November 5th with the other species and running to January 29th. As for white-fronted geese or speckled-bellied geese, the management plan for white-fronted geese currently only allows for a 72-day season. Thus, we would open concurrent with the other seasons, other geese and duck seasons, and then run 72 days and then close that season, that being January 15th this year. As for the expected bag limit in the eastern zone, we expect 3 Canada geese, 2 white-fronted geese, and then 20 light geese. To look at that on a calendar, the purple dates denote, with the light blue letters, denote the Canada goose only season we're proposing for the east zone. The gray boxes with the yellow lettering denote the white-fronted goose season, and then you can see continuing on in the gray boxes is the Canada goose and light goose seasons ending on January 29th. And in blue, you can see the beginning of the conservation order. Moving on to the west zone, highlighted in red. This is a little simpler, basically because it's simple calendar shifts from last season. To begin light goose season, as well as dark goose, November 5th and run through February 5th, with a bag limit on light geese being 20. And dark geese, the bag limit will be no more than, will be a bag limit of 5, of which no more than 1 can be a white-fronted goose in that zone. Again, to look at that on a calendar, the gray boxes denote the regular season for light and dark geese, with the blue boxes illustrating the beginning of the conservation order running to March 25th. As I mentioned, we move on to the light goose conservation order. Another way to look at it is in the west zone, beginning February 6th, the day after season's close. Similarly in the east zone, the day after season close being January 30th, and both seasons ending March 25th. As for sandhill cranes, Zone A.
Excuse me, Kevin.
Yes, sir.
Question on the light geese conservation provisions. I guess this is 65321, which is on page 23 of our book.
Yes, sir.
Couple of questions. Under subpart C, it says a person may give, leave, receive, or possess. What does the word leave mean?
Basically, I believe what that means, and I probably get clarification from Robert McDonald, but I believe that means just gifting and not having to, basically it's eliminating some of the restrictions associated with possession limits that have been tied up with the regular season birds. So just making it easier for people to get rid of their birds, basically, if they harvest a lot of birds.
It seems to me we ought to say gift, because I think you could interpret the word leave to mean you could just leave them
on the field.
That could be ways. Now, we also have under that same subpart that to participate, you've got to have all this information, the name of the person receiving the bird, the number and species of the bird, the date of... Is that all of that really necessary if the person's licensed?
That's... Federal framework, federal rule that's
required by
you. Yes, sir. That's basically federal rule that we're required to follow in order to hold that season.
Okay, and then my last question is, do we really find that this works where it's only permitted February 26th to March 25th. Haven't most of the birds moved out by then?
We do have a being at the southern end of the flyway. There are years at which Texas doesn't get to participate very much in that season. But in the east zone, which is the majority of our goose, our snow goose hunting, you can see we do open it earlier than we do in our west zone to take advantage of those birds while they're still here. For example, this year it was extremely cold throughout the Midwest in February, and those individuals were able to take very much advantage of a delayed migration, those birds, and it worked out very well, and they had almost the two full months of hunting down there.
But so, the ability to use the calls and the that sort of thing, you can't do that in the east zone until you get past the season.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
And what I'm asking is there a way to, have you considered whether this special season should be moved up in either area, Dave?
My name is Dave Morrison. I'm a small game program leader. Part of the thing with the Light Goose Conservation Order, all migratory bird seasons have to be closed before you can implement these special provisions. That is a guideline of the Fish and Wildlife Service. So that before we can open the special Light Goose Conservation Order, other seasons have to be closed. For example, the sandhill crane season, we would certainly, there's those people in that Zone C would like to see that run later. But in order to take advantage of the conservation order, when those birds are here, we run it concurrent and close with the duck season. So, yes, sir, there is some advantages trying to do it. We've looked at possibly doing it at the splits and times like that. But you run up against the fact that there are other migratory game bird seasons open. That is a key consideration with respect to how the Fish and Wildlife Service set up the Light Goose Conservation Order.
But what what is open in February? This shows that
the only thing that would be open would be the snipe season, and snipe is one that they have given us an allowance for.
Dave, just as a matter of clarification, are we proposing that we open the Light Goose Conservation Order season on February 6th or February 26th?
6th.
Okay, there's a discrepancy in the book. It suggests the 26th, so we'll fix that. February 6th is the date, so I think that'll resolve that.
I apologize. I did not see that.
It's on page 24 of our book. It says 26th. That's why I was focused on that.
Okay, we'll get that fixed.
Thank you.
One other quick thing, the leave part, if you want to leave them at a picker or leave them with somebody, that's basically what they're talking about, leaving them with someplace other than what you as the person that took those birds. So there's lots of different things. Gifting is one thing, and so there are different ways of handling how you leave those birds at one place. Regardless, if you leave them and they're no longer in your possession, you have to have that information with them that identifies who took them.
Well, I'm just suggesting we clarify maybe at the end of the sentence say provided that in no event you may not waste it.
That's no problem. We can get something in there on that.
I just think that's subject to
it. Sure. Thank you.
I believe we're on Sandhill Cranes proposals. With respect to Zone A in blue, this is nothing more than a calendar shift we're proposing to you from last year. That basically is a season that runs concurrent with the proposed goose seasons, running from November 5th to February 5th with a bag limit of 3 birds. Zone B, in accordance with our agreement with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to have a delayed opener associated with whooping crane migration, our proposal is November 25th through February 5th. And then in Zone C, there's a slight change here that we're proposing, that having to do with the closing of duck season. Thus, this proposal we have here would be a week delay in the Zone C season, that this year being December 24th and running to January 29th with a bag limit of 2. Suggested dates for extended falconry season. These dates, it's important to note, have been vetted through the Falconry and Raptor Council, and they are in agreement with these dates. With respect to doves, our proposed seasons are November 17th through December 23rd, which is the time period between the split. Ducks, both the north and south zones only, we are allowed 15 extra days, so we'd run that January 30th through February 13th. Basically 15 days after the close of duck season, then Rails, Gallinules, and Woodcock beginning January 30th, similarly, and running to February 13th. And with that...
15 days more than last year?
No, sir. It's 15 days in addition to allowable frameworks. We're allowed with
so in terms of overall falconry opportunity, how does this compare to previous years?
Similar, exactly the same, with the exception of the season is will begin a week later because of the proposed duck season.
Sounds good.
Sir.
Thank you, Kevin. Any other questions?
Sure.
All right. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
All right. No further discussion. I'll authorize staff to publish the proposed changes in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Committee item 3, public lands proclamation. Request permission to publish. Linda Campbell.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and Commissioners. For the record, I'm Linda Campbell. I'm Program Director of the Private Lands and Public Hunting Program in the Wildlife Division. And today we have two proposed amendments to the public lands proclamation. Blue Elbow Swamp, Tony Hausman Wildlife Management Area State Park, has been a wildlife management area since 1997, but due to an oversight was never added to the list of WMAs currently contained in the Public Lands Proclamation. The proposed amendment would correct that oversight. Also, advances in propulsion systems technology have increased the ability of shallow draft vessels to operate in very shallow waters and wetlands, which poses threats to habitat by disturbing soils and vegetation. Current rules prohibit the use of airboats on wildlife management areas except by executive order or written permission, and several WMAs impose site-specific restrictions on the operation of motorboats. However, the terms airboat and motorboat are not defined by rule. The proposed amendment would supply a regulatory meaning of those terms for enforcement purposes. Here are the proposed definitions, and I'll give you a moment to look at those. So, Mr. Chairman, with approval of the committee, staff will publish the proposed amendments in the Texas Register for public comment. And I thank you for your attention and try to answer any questions you might have.
Yes, Linda, sir. On the definition, proposed definition of motorboat, would that, it seems to me that might not cover a situation where it is a motorboat, but it's at the time the person is confronted, it's not being propelled by machinery. Shouldn't that see, don't you mean a vessel capable of being propelled by machinery?
That might, that.
I mean, because somebody can turn the motor
off. Yes, sir,
off,
I see that. Yes.
But you do that.
Yeah.
People do that all the time.
Or any vessel propelled by machinery.
Capable of being propelled.
Chairman, for the record, I'm Clayton Wolf of Wildlife Division. We did have some discussions about this and compared that to motorboat definitions, and I forget in what part of the code, a separate part of the code, but some of our discussions involve folks that might motor to a restricted area and then want to pole, paddle, or oar further in there. And so there was discussion about this, you know, because, for instance, on the Murphy area, We have areas that takes a while to get out there, and so they'll motor to the area, and then we have restricted areas that are posted, at what point they're no longer allowed motorized access. So at that point, folks can pole, paddle, or push, however, even though they have an outboard motor or go devil or what have you on there. So there was some intent to describing how it was being propelled, I guess, if it were discovered by law enforcement division. As opposed to the purpose.
You cover it in other aspects of the regulations because the object is that it's not being propelled by a mechanized means at the time you're in this qualified area.
That's correct, because they could have an outboard motor, but they need the outboard motor to get, you know, to some of those areas further out there, and then it's just when they get to that point, it's the means of propulsion at that time when they're in the restricted area.
Where is that in
That's not in there. The way we looked at it is the first sentence there, that is being propelled, and so we read that to meant whatever the, once they're in there, it's the means of propulsion for that boat while it's there. And we'd take any suggestions for anything that might further clarify that, obviously.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, that answers my question.
Thank you.
Linda, thank you very much. Any other questions for Linda? Okay. No further questions or discussion. I'll authorize staff to publish the proposed changes in the Texas Register for the required public comment period. Committee item four, briefing on the February freeze event and closures. Rebecca Hendley.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, for the record, I'm Rebecca Hensley with the Coastal Fisheries Division, located out of the Dickinson office just north of Galveston Bay. I'm here to basically update you on our past February freeze, as well as talk to you a little bit about our thermal refuge closures during that time period. Late January, we had a prediction of a severe Arctic front that was going to impact the coast from the 1st to the 4th of February, bringing coastwide temperatures anywhere between 25 to 38 degrees. And at that time period, we kind of went into a response readiness mode, talked to several different divisions, communications, law enforcement, inland, coastal, fisheries, and wildlife, and trying to get ready for the onset as well as the post-freeze assessment. And we also talked about some proactive measures with respect to enhancing survivability of the fish with our thermal refuge closures, as well as some land cut, barge traffic stoppage during the land cut in the Upper Laguna Madre. Well, the freeze actually did hit the 1st of February, the night of the 1st, and the temperatures actually were a little longer, hitting about the first 2 weeks of February with a slight warming period. In that time period, the air temperatures along the coast dropped to 22 degrees. The water temperatures in all of the bay systems, at least part of them, hit freezing, and we had at least 2 days of 45-degree water temperatures along the entire coast. This was the first time that we have used, that our executive director has used the authority that was granted by the 2005 commission to, following the 2004 freeze, to actually close some of the deep water or thermal refuge sites where fish are known to congregate during the cold water events. And based on the predictions, the weather predictions, the coastwide impact, as well as the duration of the freeze, this closure was initially implemented to be the 2nd through the 5th of February. And as I said earlier, the duration of the freeze actually was longer. So what was done was we extended the freeze, the temporary recreational closure, to the 7th of February. And again, 21 sites that have been previously designated along the entire coast for thermal refuges where fish normally congregate. A significant voluntary effort occurred with the Gulf Intracoastal Canal Association, which is a group of barge operators that voluntarily shut down, ceased their traffic in the Upper Laguna Madre, a section called the Land Cut, which is south of Baffin Bay, north of Port Mansfield. And they closed or stopped their barge traffic from the 3rd, which is Thursday through Saturday. Again, that was to enhance the survival of those fish, to minimize the prop damage of those fish that are in the deep water areas, as well as prop wash, which actually causes sedimentation and potential asphyxiation of those fish with silt on the gills. Again, a significant effort which impacted those companies at roughly $7,000 a day each day of the closure during those freeze, during the freeze event. So what happened with our fish? What was impacted? Along the coast, we saw at least 290,000 fish killed, with the majority of those fish being what we considered non-recreational species, forage and other species. Those were primarily dominated by hardhead catfish, silver perch, and mullet. We had less than 20% of those fish killed were recreational species, running about 8% sheep's head, and less than 8% spotted sea trout, red drum, and black drum. Again, we saw a substantial number of turtle strandings at over 1,500. Each of the bay systems had slightly different species compositions and impacts. For example, Matagorda Bay had the majority of the fish impacts, with over 160,000 fish killed. The recreational species there that were impacted were black drum and sheep's head, in comparison to the Lower Laguna Madre, which had about 35,000 fish killed, and the primary species impacted recreationally was sheep's head at about 50%.
Let me go back just quickly on the stranded turtles.
Yes, sir.
Did we was there some help and volunteer help? Were we able to save any of those stranded turtles? Or when you say stranded and died, or stranded and...
They were stranded, and I have a slide just for that, and I'll go into a little more detail for that.
You're way ahead of me.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
In comparing the historical freezes to where we are right now at 2011, looking at 1983 and the two 1989 freezes, those made up about 32 million fish that were killed during those three events. And the 2011 freeze was significant, but in comparison, it was most similar, at least in the total number of fish killed, to the 1997 freeze. Again, 2004, 2010 were other freezes, barely hitting this graph because of the scale of the mortality, but we saw about 31 and 55,000 fish in those 2 years, respectively.
Obviously, you went back and compared, like, 83 and 89, were they just much... more extreme freezes, lasted longer, more fish, walk me through.
The temperatures were much more severe.
We
had some predictions that the 2011 freeze would be as severe as that. Thankfully, it wasn't.
Yeah.
Colder temperatures, much colder than 45, which usually is the lethal thermal tolerance for many of our species, and a long, long period of cold weather. Ice on the shoreline. This picture next, the ones on the left are 1983.
I remember
so pretty substantial. And just comparing those, the 1980 freezes with 1997 and 2011, using spotted sea trout, red drum, and black drum. In 1983 and the two combined 1989 freezes, less than 1% of those species killed were those three species. But again, 1 million fish in 1983 of those three species, and 1 million in the combined 1989. 1997 was a little bit different than 2011. We had the majority of those fish that were killed during that freeze were recreational species, with almost 75% being spotted sea trout, red drum, and black drum. And again, in 2011, less than 8% of those three species. Sea turtle strandings. Basically, this was a big surprise for us. We had stunned sea turtles, a huge effort with public, a lot of volunteers, federal groups, and a lot of Texas Parks and Wildlife staff, law enforcement, communications, coastal fisheries. They were on the water picking up turtles as they got on the shoreline as soon as the freeze began, and it was that rapid response. We quickly realized that there were not enough facilities to hold and hold these turtles as the U.S. Fish and Wildlife normally does, and walk through the warming period, get them into a rehab facility, get them into the water, and then release them when the air temperature warmed up. So utilizing some of the other states that have had record cold sea turtle strandings, they said get these sea turtles into the Gulf waters as quickly as possible, as long as those waters warm up. And we were lucky enough to have a warm period in between those two freezes, and we had 700 turtles that were released in the Gulf on Sunday the 6th, very successfully with those temperatures over about 50, 52 degrees. So that's something we will be using. Again, a big effort on Parks and Wildlife, equipment, staff, facilities. We participated in all levels of the pickup, transport, storage, rehab.
So very little observed mortality in turtles?
We had a little over 200 turtles that were that died, and compared to 2010, last year we had over 400 turtles that were picked up, and two-thirds of those were dead. So pretty significant turtle survival with this. Most of these were greens.
So the awareness level over the last few years has really changed and raised the volunteerism and the help that you get immediately, as you said.
Well, surprisingly enough, with all the ice on the roads, we still had people on the water after the turtles.
Yeah. I noticed one guy had his Spurs T-shirt on, so he... That's why.
You didn't pay for that, did you?
Yeah, right. I better get that blown up. I need that picture.
Well, and as with everything that we do, the first time we close these thermal refuges, we go back, and as well as with our freeze event, what could we do better? And one of the things we are working on now is getting the message out a little better with respect to our thermal refuges. That includes additional signage, some additional maps and tools for both anglers and law enforcement during these time periods, as well as some site assessments of those thermal refuges, the boundaries, locations, are they conducive to recreational angling going on, are they appropriate? And with respect to our fisheries, we took a pretty good hit, thankfully not as bad as 1983 and 89. With respect to the impacts along the coast, we will monitor through this next year, as we always do after all freezes, and assess the full impact with our fisheries monitoring program. And if there are needed recommendations for management strategies, we'll provide those. And so with that, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, I conclude my comments.
Thanks, Rebecca. That's really great work. Yeah. Questions or?
I'm just curious as to how you extrapolate the numbers of them when you're talking millions of fish or hundreds of.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked
that. Well, with a lot of field effort, we basically try to get up in the air, utilize law enforcement plane to overflight to the coast, get the extent of the impact. Usually, it's a few days after the freeze when fish start floating. And then we get people on the ground and do subsets, subsamples, and extrapolate for those areas. So it's a lot of field time.
So you're fairly comfortable with your counts and how you count?
The counts have been consistent since 1983, or that the procedures have been consistent. Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. That's great.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Committee item five. I think is where we are. 2011-2012 Statewide Hunting Proclamation recommended adoption of proposed changes. Jason Hart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioners, for the record, my name is Jason Harden, Upland Game Bird Specialist with Texas Parks and Wildlife. I'm here today to present proposed regulation changes impacting wild turkey season structure and the mule deer managed land deer program. I'd like to start out by discussing three proposed regulation changes that, if adopted, will take effect during the 2011-2012 wild turkey season. These proposals were developed through our Upland Game Bird Technical Committee, consisting of Parks and Wildlife staff, and have been presented to the Upland Game Bird Advisory Committee during a briefing this past August and again in November. The Advisory Committee viewed the opinions of the Upland Game Bird Committee favorably. The first proposal is to close 15 of the current 43 counties open for spring eastern turkey season. The eastern turkey season is unique in Texas, and that is the only game animal that is required to be reported following harvest. All harvested birds must be reported to one of our 90-plus mandatory check stations within 24 hours of harvest. The harvest data collected helps us to implement management strategies. The counties recommended for closure are delineated here in black and listed to the left of the map. Closures are recommended due to less than one bird on average being reported for these counties over a minimum period of 3 years, with several of these counties going quite a bit longer without reporting a harvest. Based on hunter, landowner, and TPWD biologist observations, there appears to be a lack of brood stock in these counties to support a season. Closing these counties provides us with the opportunity to move forward with new stocking strategies. The results of public comment found that 95% of responders support closing these 15 counties. Out of 78 responders, 4 disagreed with closing these counties. Some of the comments included open the season on April 15th in these counties and shorten the season to 2 weeks, and another disagreed with closing these counties if restocking did not take place concurrently. The second proposal is to delay the opening of the eastern turkey season by 2 weeks. The current season opens April 1 and runs through April 30. The proposed season would open April 15 and close May 14. Research conducted in East Texas has identified a median nest initiation date falling in the middle of April. Research conducted in 07 and 08 looked at nest initiation data of 98 nesting attempts. The median nest initiation fell on 16 April. This change will assure that the majority of hens have been bred by the available gobblers before the season opens, and reduce the risk of accidental hen harvest because the majority of the hens will be sitting on a nest and incubating eggs for up to 23 hours a day. The results of public comment found that 87% of respondents support the season shift. Of 76 respondents, 10 disagreed with the season date shift. Public comments included the season should remain the same, a 2-week season is long enough, May is too hot, and gobbling activity has ceased by mid-May, and one comment provided was not germane to the proposal. The third proposal is to change the spring Rio Grande turkey season in the north and south zones from a gobbler-only season to an any bearded bird season. This change reflects the bag of most states with spring turkey season. Currently, all but five of the north and south zones have a fall season that allow for the harvest of up to 4 hens. Bearded hens make up a small fraction of the hen population. However, many hunters rely on a beard as an indicator of a gobbler. Due to the low number of bearded hens available for harvest, this change will have little to no impact on the Texas Rio Grande turkey population. The results of public comment found that 89% of respondents support the season shift in the spring bag. Of 88 respondents, 10 disagreed with the shift. Public comments included keep it gobblers only. Hunters should be able to identify bearded hens from gobblers. One commenter said that he was unaware of any other states that allow for the harvest of bearded hens in the spring, and that 5% value seemed too low. The last proposal is modification to the current mule deer MLDP. We're proposing a minor change to the mule deer MLDP that would primarily be a housekeeping measure. We'd like to clarify the rules to state that MLD permits for mule deer are valid during the archery-only season for the take of mule deer with legal archery equipment. This modification will help clear up any confusion with respect to when tags can be used. The results of public comments found that 90% of respondents support the cleanup in the language as it pertains to mule deer MLDP permits. Of 72 respondents, 7 disagreed with the cleanup of language, but none of the comments were germane to the proposal.
Straightforward. Any questions?
Sir Duggan. Jason, I think it's the third slide that says proposed county closures, 15 counties closed.
Yeah.
What's
what now? Sorry?
For Eastern
this
Turkey.
Slide.
Right, yeah. Okay.
I'm just curious why, if you look at the counties that are beige where it wouldn't be closed,
mm-hmm.
and that little finger comes into the
or to Shelby County
closure area. What's different about those counties? Why do they have a population that's huntable and those that are?
It's almost entirely habitat related. A lot of this country is consistent with industry land, paper industry, timber industry, and national forest land. There's a considerable amount of prescribed burning that takes place in these areas. So habitat's maintained year in and year out. In the northern half, it becomes post-oak savanna with little fingers of blackland prairie, which has a nice open understory, lots of diversity of open habitat, which provides good brooding cover. So the habitat's just a little bit different between those two areas, and it's mostly a management scenario.
But you think it's primarily a habitat issue?
I think it's primarily a habitat issue. But there may be some opportunity over to the west. The finger that you're talking about, I would say, is almost exactly just habitat related.
Thanks.
Any questions for Dave? Comments? Okay. Thank you. I'll place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Item number 6, 2011-12 statewide fishing proclamation. Recommended adoption of proposed changes. Robin Rikers. How are you, Robin?
Good morning, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Robin Rikers of the Coastal Fisheries Division, and I'm here to present the 2011-2012 Coastal Fisheries statewide proposals. As indicated before, none of the changes that we have before you are substantive in nature. They're either clarifications of previous intent or kind of clarifying the language so that it's better understood at this point in time. Two of those are correcting minimum leak limits in the proclamation regarding gag grouper and snook, and then the clarifications are regarding the use of the bait on circle hooks and the bycatch retention associated with shrimp vessels. Again, as indicated, the corrections to the minimum link limits were correcting typographical error that had gag grouper at 37 inches, and the intent in previous action was to put that at a 22-inch minimum link limit. And for snook, the correction changes it from 22 to 24 inches as the rule was previous, as your action had previously left it at. In addition, regarding circle hooks, we're clarifying that circle hooks are required when fishing with natural bait for red snapper. There was some confusion over this, whether you had to put basically alter a artificial bait if you were using some sort of artificial bait as well, and we're clarifying that it's only when being used for red snapper. That's consistent with the federal rule that's outside of 9 nautical miles. That'll make our rule inside of 9 nautical miles consistent with that, and obviously eliminate confusion for the anglers who are trying to abide by those rules. Then lastly, we're clarifying that on commercial shrimp boats, only those people who have either a shrimp boat owner or the actual license for the vessel or the shrimp boat captain's license are the people who can retain a recreational bag limit on board the vessel. There's been some confusion. Some people are exempted from that license if someone on board has that shrimp boat owner's license or the vessel license, or they have the captain's license. The other members of the crew may not have to have a license, and there's been some confusion over whether they could keep a recreational bag limit, and we're going and indicating to them, no, that you actually have to have that. Either the owner has to be on board with their license, or the captain, the person has to have a shrimp boat captain's license. When you look at the comment summary, you can see overwhelming support for this. None of our constituents felt strongly enough to come to any of our public hearings in regards to this, but all of these are based on our web comments at this point, and overwhelming support for that. With that, that concludes my presentation, and be happy to answer any other questions.
Thanks, Robin. Commissioner Rob, has it been a year since the flounder reductions have been in place?
The fall would have been the second year that those would have been in place. So yes, we're 2 years into those rule reductions.
And do you have any update on that that might impact whether there should be further adjustments to the flounder?
As we discussed when we passed the rule, 3 years is where we really kind of make our benchmark. But certainly, anecdotally, we can suggest to you that we believe some of those rules are having the impact that we desired. But we certainly would like to review that in our next statewide cycle and be ready to come back to you with any changes that we'd recommend.
Okay. I'm down on the coast. Everybody tells me there are more flounder than there have ever been. Why haven't I changed the rule back? You haven't heard that yet, Robin, have you?
Well,
we
still hear that one, yes.
Yeah, exactly.
That probably started the day after we changed the rule. But.
Yeah, well, naturally. We heard it the day of the rule. Yeah. But at least anecdotally, it does seem to be helping the fishery.
Thanks, Rob. Appreciate it. Ken, moving inland.
Good morning, Commissioners. My name is Ken Krasowski, the Inland Fisheries Division, and I'm here to go over the proposed changes to the freshwater fishing regulations. Starting off, we have change on Wheeler Branch, which is a new reservoir that's going to be opening this fall near Glen Rose, and our goal there is to protect and enhance the new fishery that we've been working on since the reservoir filled in 2007. Typically, what we want to do is try and give some harvest protection to those new populations, and the regulations that we're proposing there are to slot limit for largemouth bass, 14 to 21 inch slot with 5 fish daily bag, 1 fish over 21 inches, 18 inch minimum for smallmouth bass with 3 fish bag, and then a gear restriction there to pole and line only to help cut down on some of the higher harvest there, just to distribute the catch, and also the nature of the reservoir there that with the Somerville Water District, this would be more compatible with some of the uses there.
Was the reservoir built for a water supply for?
Yes, it's for some. Yeah. Somerville Water District supply, and they're also you know, want to do recreation. There's a park around.
Sure.
So
yes.
Next, Lake Kyle, which is a small 12-acre existing lake just south of Austin here near in the Plum Creek development. And they're developing it as a public park within that subdivision, and it's set to open to limited public access next year. And it has an excellent largemouth bass population existing in there. Because of the small size and the potential for over-harvest, staff would like to protect that population. We're going to go with the 14-21 inch slot limit for largemouth bass also in there, and this reservoir will also fall under our community fishing lake regulations, which is a reduced harvest for reduced bag limit for channel catfish and blue catfish 5, no size limit, and also pole and line angling only in those smaller reservoirs.
Ken, before you move on to that, on the community lake, isn't there also a limitation on the number of poles?
Yes, there's a two pole limit on our community fishing lakes.
And then the next question is, when you say limited public access, what do you mean?
There'll be I think there'll be a certain number of people that they allow on at a time to prevent overcrowding on the lake.
Will determine who's allowed?
Well, it would be just sort of a first come, first serve, and there would be also a time. It'll be open, the park will open at a certain time and close at a certain time. So, but there won't be any difference between, you know, community residents or outs, you know, people can come from the outside. It would just be a first come, first serve, whatever the parking lot could hold there. It's a small
water.
Who
will determine that? That's my question.
Well, I think it's just whoever, you know, when it's full, it's full. That's the only.
To get to your question, who actually manages it?
It'll be they're creating a public park. The Plum Creek area is creating the public park. It'll be open to the public.
So it'll be the city monitoring.
Not the city
who
of
the
homeowners association, Kim.
Well, yeah. It'll be a public lake, so it'll be our law enforcement will.
It'll be our law enforcement.
Right.
That's my question. It's our law.
Right. It'll be a public water body. Yes. Once it gets open to the public.
But they will control access, even though we're effectively a state lake.
Yes, you know, it's typical of any, you know, like a power plant lake that we have agreements with them to allow people to fish there. And if we do the, you know, if they allow anyone from the public to fish without, you know, discrimination.
It's not uncommon to have that type of
relationship. Sure. And then we would manage, if they allow the public to fish it in any way, we will manage it, stock it.
I know what you're getting at there. And
That's you know
how that's handled is obviously important. It's still a state resource,
right? But it is rather small lake, so they can't just don't want it being overrun by people and having problems with people parking.
I know I'm going to hear that.
Thanks. Next at Lake Allen Henry, our goals there for our proposed changes are to allow anglers to harvest some of the smaller spotted bass and also reduce some of the identification problems between some of the bass species we have there. We're going to remove the 18-inch minimum for spotted bass and combine the spotted bass and largemouth bass limits. So that'll be a 5-fish bag and will allow you to catch two bass spotted a largemouth less than 18 inches. We stocked the spotted bass, Alabama spotted bass in there, which are a strain that gets to be a larger size, and the fish pictured there is actually a state record spotted bass that was caught there in January 15th of this year. So that did produce some results in that reservoir. And then we are going to change the smallmouth bass limit back to the 14-inch statewide limit. We did stock smallmouth in there when the reservoir was opened. It hasn't produced any population whatsoever, and having an 18-inch minimum on there gives, when anglers see that, they think that's usually a regulation we typically reserve for our better lakes, trophy lakes, and Winx, it's just the opposite. There really aren't any smallmouth to speak of at all, so we're just going to let that revert back to the statewide minimum. Reservoirs Kirby and Palestine. Catfish are a popular species in both reservoirs. Population structures are similar in that there's a lot of the channel catfish are abundant and slow growing, small size, a good structure on the blue catfish population, and pretty good growth on those. And what we're trying to do there is sort of restructure those populations and reduce some of the competition among the catfish by allowing the additional harvest of channels, and the increase of this harvest of smaller catfish should enhance overproduction of the larger catfish, both channels and for the blue catfish. So we're going to change the regulations there from the statewide limits, which is a 12-inch 25 fish bag limit, to a no minimum length limit, and a 50 fish daily bag width of only 5 can be over 20 inches or greater. We're going to try and maintain some of those blue catfish. Mainly those larger fish that will be caught are the blue catfish. Anglers have said their desires to harvest some of those smaller catfish, so we'll see if that additional harvest helps restructure that population. And finally, we have a suite of changes on the Texas-Louisiana border waters. Both states have agreed to some proposed changes on Toledo Bend and the Sabine River and also on cattle. And our goal there is to standardize our regulations as much as possible on the border waters. We typically meet on a regular basis with the staffs of Louisiana and Oklahoma to try and get those regulations on our border waters like Toledo Bend or Lake Texoma as similar as we possible for ease of enforcement, ease of understanding for the anglers, and also to protect good quality fishing in those reservoirs. I might note that approval here by you is contingent on the Wildlife and Fisheries Commission in Louisiana vote on approval. They will vote on January 2nd. We're hopeful that they will
June 2nd.
And hopefully they will approve all these changes, but until they actually do, we don't know that. They've given us they're working towards them, so we're hopeful that we'll be able to get all these approved by their commission also. They're holding public hearings on in Louisiana in early April, so they maybe we'll get a little better idea of how it'll go over there. They don't see any major problems at this time.
There's been a lot of groundwork laid on this, just so you know, with our fisheries biologists, working with their fisheries biologists, their secretary, et cetera. And so we certainly sense that they are committed to doing this, but they just have to go through their process as well. And this would allow us to synchronize the approvals between the two commissions. So hence the reason for the kind of the caveat on that.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of momentum and motivation on their side to approve, to get these as close as possible also. So looking at Toledo Bend Reservoir, some of the proposed changes we have there are we're changing the blue and channel catfish regulation to the no minimum length limit, 50 fish bag with the 5 fish over 20 inches, which is similar to what we're proposing on Kirby and Palestine. So that'll help us give us another few reservoirs we could, and all these regulations, that's a new regulation for us. It'll give us another opportunity for our staffs to get out there and evaluate those and see if they're achieving the goals for those. We're going to slightly modify the catfish. We're going to stay with 8 for flathead catfish, 18-inch minimum with a 10-fish bag. And we're going to, the big one that we've talked about years with them, the crappie reg, we're going to remove the minimum length limit and go with the 25-fish combined bag there. And then also we have to modify the upper limit of the existing Toledo Bend reservoir definition to include the area up to the Texas-Louisiana state line. I have a number of changes on the Sabine River. Some of these are ones that are existing exceptions on Toledo Bend Reservoir. We're trying to make from the upper end of Toledo Bend all the way down to I-10 have the regulations similar, so we have those same regulations for channel and blues, the flatheads and white and black crappies, and then the striped bass, white bass, and largemouth bass and spotted regs are the existing regs that we have agreed upon in the reservoir itself. And this would apply from that area from the Toledo Bend Dam downstream to the I-10 bridge, which is the boundary of the freshwater, saltwater zone. And then finally on cattle, we have some of those similar changes for the catfish, blues and channels and flatheads. We're going with the no minimum length limit, 25 fish bag on crappie, similar white bass, no minimum length limit, 25 fish bag. We have on largemouth, we have agreed upon a 14 to 18 inch slot there with the 8 fish bag with only 4 largemouth over that 18 inches, and then a no minimum on the spotted bass. And I have that largemouth, some of the highlights there for largemouth and spotted in your books. It's not as specific as we need to make it as far as noting on page 143 there that the slot just pertains to the largemouth bass, and there would be no minimum length limit on spotted bass. You could harvest any size spotted bass, so we'll have to make those changes in the final version. And this is our summary of comment on this. For Wheeler Branch and Lake Kyle, some of the comments we had opposing that were just general comments on people don't like slot limits in general, or thought we should have a little smaller slot limit there. For Lake Allen Henry, some of the people that are against that were saying we should even allow more harvests of more spotted bass than we're allowing at this time. And certainly that's this regulation to allow the harvest of some of the smaller bass was generated by a lot of the angler comments and what we see developing in the spotted bass population. So we're going to go in there and evaluate how well this regulation is doing to on the spotted bass population, and that's something we can consider, allowing more small harvests of more smaller spotted bass there in the future. No specific comments opposing on Kirby and Palestine. And then for the border waters, most of the comments opposing that are from people saying we should maintain some of our minimum lengths on crappie or a little different slot or size limit on bass. So no outright opposition to what we're trying to attempt to do there to standardize those regulations. So those are all our changes and public comment, and based on that, other than those minor modifications to the largemouth and spotted bass regs on cattle are the only changes we would need to go forward with.
Thank you, Ken. Any discussion or questions? Commissioner Doug?
Ken, two things. One, when are you projected to get back with the report on the alligator guard situation?
That's ongoing. We did present something in January on that. Gave some additional information. We'll probably be evaluating that on a yearly basis, certainly.
But you're comfortable that regulations should stay the same at this point?
Yes. It's just been a couple years, and that's a long-lived species. It takes a while in those types of species to see changes in the population structure. So, that's something our staff there at Heart of the Hills is continuing to devote a lot of effort to looking those, working with the bow anglers to get information. So that's something we're very interested in staying on top of, and if we have to make any changes there to pursue those.
Okay, second question is, in your discussions with the Louisiana biologists, are you also talking about the problems with invasives? This is all a bit off the track, but I'm just curious, you do have that forum to visit and coordinate whatever efforts can be made on that.
We do, absolutely, talking to them about giant salvinia issues or water hyacinth and hydrilla. So those conversations are ongoing. In fact, I visited with a group from Marshall and Senator Eltife yesterday, and they were asking about that coordination across the border on aquatic invasive species. It's top of mind for folks up there. So, yeah, our folks are coordinating regularly on that.
Yeah, we have a staff that works out of Jasper that coordinates, with the Louisiana people on the Toledo Bend and on the giant salvinia and the other issues over there.
And does that also include law enforcement on boater education, that sort of thing?
Yeah. And, a big focus as of late has been the zebra mussel up at Texoma, and a big educational push with inland fisheries and law enforcement and communication, North Texas Municipal Water District, Corps of Engineers, and others, to try to see if we can do everything we can to contain the zebra mussels in that body. That's a formidable proposition. I want to make sure everybody understands the risk that that we have there, that everybody's really working, I think, well together on that.
Including the state in Oklahoma.
In Oklahoma. Now, they've got zebra mussels in Oklahoma.
Multiple reservoirs.
Yeah, so unfortunately, they're learning how to live with them. We're trying to contain them, if at all possible, to keep them just in that one water body. We do not want them to get in the Trinity River and move downstream to other water bodies. So good cooperation and on the education front in particular.
Great. Thank you. Any questions? Ken? Thank you. Appreciate it. Okay, I'll place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. And Chairman Holt, this committee has completed its discussion.
Thank you, sir.